A 2-year-old Desiree Carroll was last seen near her home in a heavily wooded area of Texas on March 25, 1983. The girl's mother had dropped her and her older sister off at the end of the road leading to the house, and Desiree was last seen walking back down that road away from her house. No trace of her has ever been found. Did she wander off into the woods, or was foul play involved? 41 years later, there are no answers. Hello, and welcome to Box in the Basement podcast. I'm your host, Arlene.
And I'm Leah.
In 1996, my world was shattered when my uncle Leon Lorellas was shot execution style in a small town in Texas. To this day, his murder remains unsolved, and the pain of that injustice continues to haunt me, my family, and Leon's friends and co-workers. Here at Box in the Basement, we want to shed light on the overwhelming number of unsolved murders and disappearances here in Texas and beyond. Ultimately, we want to get justice for Leon and for all the victims whose cases are sitting, collecting dust in a box in a basement.
In 1983, a Hezbollah attack in Beirut, Lebanon, killed 237 U.S. Marines in their barracks. The Marines were part of a multinational peacekeeping force deployed during the Lebanese Civil War. A Soviet jet shot down a South Korean 747 carrying 269 people after it allegedly strayed into Soviet airspace. Sally Ride became the first American woman in space as part of the Challenger crew. Compact discs began to go mainstream, starting a steep decline in vinyl record sales. The internet went live, and the first cell phones became available to the public. Michael Jackson's Billie Jean was number one on the Billboard Hot 100 the week of March 25th, and Ricky Skaggs topped the Hot Country chart with I Wouldn't Change You If I Could. High Road to China was number one at the box office that week, though Return of the Jedi would be the highest-grossing film of the year. Super Mario Brothers made its debut in 1983, as did Cabbage Patch Kids, Nerds Candy, Axe Body Spray, and the Choco Taco. Some sources have Desiree Carroll missing from Cossey, Texas, and some list her place of disappearance as Santa Fe, Texas. She lived in a secluded area. Most articles use Cossey as the frame of reference, so that's what we'll use here. Cossey is a very small town in Limestone County, Texas, which is in the east-central part of the state. It's about 42 miles southeast of Waco and 52 miles north of Bryan and College Station. As of 2019, the estimated population of the town was 466. The population was slightly higher when Desiree Carroll disappeared, though it probably wasn't over 500 people. Cossey, a little town with a big heart, is mostly surrounded by farms and ranches, which make up the backbone of the county. A small oil boom led to a population influx early in the 20th century, but the supply quickly dissipated, people left town, and the Great Depression depleted the population further. Today, just a handful of businesses remain. There is a large sand plant nearby, and the town continues to support the farmers and ranchers in the area.
Desiree Desi Carroll was born on July 2, 1980, to Ann and Reggie Carroll. Desiree's parents got divorced shortly after her birth, and Ann got primary custody of Desiree and her older sister, Heather. Shortly before this incident occurred, Ann moved herself and her children into a house a few miles southwest of Cossey that belonged to her boyfriend at the time, David Morris. This house was pretty isolated. It was a heavily wooded area, which will come into play as the story progresses. Despite being divorced, both Desiree's parents played an active role in her and her sister's life, and their father, Reggie, saw the girls regularly. On the afternoon of March 25th, Anne left the house to travel to nearby Marlin, Texas. There was a fairly long lane or driveway that went from their house to the front gate, about 100 yards in length, and Anne let the girls ride in the truck with her to the end of the driveway. She stopped the truck and let the girls out at the gate at around 1 p.m. Anne reported seeing Heather walking up this lane or road back toward the house. Desiree, who remember was only 2 and a half at the time, was walking away from where the house would have been, essentially following Anne as she drove off. The sources we have say that Desiree was last seen walking into the woods near the house. And I'm assuming the lane or driveway leading to the house was wooded on both sides from these descriptions. The last person to see Desiree alive was her 5-year-old sister, Heather. So I'm also assuming that the information about her allegedly walking off into the woods came from her. Or perhaps that's just an assumption that was made after the fact. That's just one of the many mysteries in this case. In any case, there is nothing to indicate that Desiree ever made it back inside her home that afternoon. At least not officially. But we'll get into theories later on. Desiree's mother reported her missing at around 6 p.m. the same day. And because she was so young, this was taken seriously right off the bat. This isn't like some of the other missing persons cases we've discussed involving adults or teenagers. 2-year-olds don't voluntarily disappear to start new lives. She would have been in imminent danger given the rural wooded location of her home. It was also still only March, so it would likely get pretty chilly later in the evening. Police, the National Guard, and several hundred volunteers from nearby quickly started scouring the area surrounding the Morris Carroll household, but found no trace of little Desiree.
When considering the disappearance of a child, investigators tend to look first at that child's inner circle, family, close friends, anyone who had regular access. Here's where things get a little sketchy. Anne and David were interviewed, of course, and David said that he was home at the time of Desiree's disappearance, babysitting the girls while their mother went to nearby Marlin to shop. From police interviews and newspaper articles at the time, investigators noted that Desiree's mother, Anne, and her boyfriend, David, both seemed aloof and showed a quote-unquote lack of emotion in the early phases of the search. David also told police that he believed Desiree had gone with Anne to Marlin, which was why he wasn't overly concerned right away and didn't report her missing. Both adults believed that Desiree had simply wandered off as opposed to being a victim of a crime. Suspicion fell on the family early on as Anne and David moved to Houston about a week after Desiree's disappearance. Some articles state that they moved from Houston to Colorado not too long after that, though that's disputed. The local authorities were pretty frustrated with this. The Limestone County Sheriff said that he'd had quote-unquote little contact with them after they left the area.
Police searched the house Desiree was living in at the time, but no sign of foul play was observed. Investigators took clothing and other items to be tested for blood evidence, but none was found. A bedsheet was found in the woods near the property. But analysis on hair found on the sheet wasn't a match to Desiree. Police initially theorized this sheet might have been used by someone carrying Desiree into the woods, but later concluded it probably had nothing to do with her disappearance. Investigators exhausted all leads by the end of 1983. Various interviews with law enforcement seemed to indicate that they'd basically given up hope. Every lead was a dead end. No trace of Desiree was ever found, and there were no eyewitnesses. The FBI and local law enforcement continued to follow up on alleged sightings and new tips, but nothing ever came of these.
So what happened to Desiree Carroll?
Law enforcement has focused on three main theories throughout the years, and I think they're the most plausible. We'll break each one down. The first theory is most obvious to anyone who's a fan of true crime stories. Someone in the family or inner circle was responsible. Law enforcement looked into Desiree's mom and her boyfriend at first, and they did find some things strange. We mentioned earlier that neither adult seemed overly emotional about the girl's disappearance, and both insisted that she just wandered off and got lost. Investigators noted that David Morris, mom's boyfriend, had some peculiar religious beliefs, and he was known to regularly, quote, discipline the girls. An early theory was that David got carried away disciplining Desiree, and she ended up dead. I tend to believe it was someone in the family, personally. It seems like the most likely scenario, and why nobody was able to find her in the woods. While the woods were thick and the terrain was pretty rugged, this is a 2-year-old baby. She wouldn't have gone that far. I think someone close to her killed her, either by mistake or on purpose, and buried her, burned her, or otherwise disposed of her where she wouldn't be found by the search crews. There is also an eyewitness that put David Morris out driving at the time he said he was at home watching the kids. I'm not really sure what to make of this. Eyewitnesses are notoriously unreliable. In this case, a gas station employee said he was talking to Desiree's mother, who happened to be at the gas station getting water, when he saw what he believed to be David Morris's little sports car driving by at around 5:15 p.m. But it was going too fast to identify the driver. Apparently, David Morris did have a sports car similar to the one seen that day, but according to David, his mother had the car in Houston at the time this would have happened. So, is this a bad eyewitness? Or was David lying? We may never know.
It's a possibility, definitely, and it rubs me the wrong way that the family just up and moved to Houston in the middle of the search.
We'll probably never know if she had anything to do with Desiree's disappearance. She died pretty young, if I recall correctly. You don't just leave town when your baby is missing. That's a huge red flag to me.
And Anne Carroll actually appeared at a Texas House Law Enforcement Committee hearing, I think, later that same year. Her testimony actually helped pass legislation that required state and local law enforcement agencies to provide free fingerprinting for children upon the request of a parent or guardian. What about the biological father? I know he said he saw the girls pretty regularly, and I'm assuming he was cleared early on.
There's not a whole lot out there about his involvement in the investigation, honestly. He claimed he last saw Desiree about 2 weeks prior to her disappearance. And that's pretty much all we have. I'm assuming he had an alibi and was cleared. If law enforcement suspected him, there's nothing about it in any of the reports or news articles that we have.
The next theory is a non-family kidnapping. And while this might seem reasonable at first glance, the more I think about it, the less likely I believe it to be. This was the early years of the Satanic Panic, so stranger abduction was closer to the front of people's minds. But we have to look at the circumstances here. Desiree and her sister weren't out in public with their mother. They were on their own property. Desiree's mother, Anne, drove the girls in her truck to the end of the driveway, essentially. She let them out at the gate, and they were supposed to walk their 100 yards or so back to the house. We've mentioned several times that this house was miles out of town. I think 10 miles from Cossey, which is a tiny town to begin with. It's on a back road in the woods, and the house is set back off that road. That a stranger would be randomly driving through right at the time Desiree was at the front gate is unlikely enough, but it would seem that Anne Carroll would have seen another car or another person in the area. I imagine there's not a ton of traffic there. Another vehicle would have stood out.
Now, if it was someone who wasn't necessarily a family member, but also wasn't a stranger. That is a more likely scenario.
Like someone who knew the family or knew of the family and waited for this kind of opportunity?
Yeah, again, not completely out of the question, but seems highly unlikely given the circumstances. But I know the non-family kidnapping scenario is the theory law enforcement thinks is the most likely. And again, I get it. No evidence of foul play in the home. Can't find her anywhere on the property. Stands to reason this would be a consideration. It's also human nature to want to believe terrible things have fantastic explanations. When a child goes missing, we don't want the simple, mundane explanation. We want our outrage and sadness to be matched with an outrageous story. You mentioned the satanic panic, and that need to exaggerate and magnify the horror is part of what fed that whole debacle. It's what feeds conspiracy theories in general.
One of the examples that I always use to explain this kind of thing is JFK. It's not satisfying enough to accept that Lee Harvey Oswald meant to kill JFK, or he was aiming for the governor of Texas and accidentally hit JFK. We have to kind of weave these elaborate stories and conspiracy theories with tons of different actors and UFOs and aliens to try to fully explain the tragedy. It's like our brains don't want to accept that it could be a really simple explanation. And it's very possible that's what's happening here. It's simply not satisfying enough to explain this little girl disappearing by saying she probably wandered off into the woods, nobody realized it until later, and now she's gone. Or someone close to her accidentally killed her, and then they covered it up.
And that leads me to the final theory, which is that Desiree Carroll simply did wander off. She was last seen by her mother walking away from the house, not up the driveway. It is reasonable to assume that she stepped into the woods and was never seen again. And then if nobody noticed for hours, which is what it seems like, she could have been anywhere. She could have fallen. She could have been hit by a tree branch or something.
And I know some of you are thinking it, so I'll address it right now. Yes, there was a massive search conducted, and no, they didn't find any trace of Desiree. But like Arlene just said, if she fell down into a hole or a ditch or a culvert or even a creek, she could have gone totally unnoticed. And it is really easy to get yourself turned around and disoriented in dense woods. I remember once I went backpacking in southern Ohio with my dad, and I wandered off the trail into the woods. I was probably only 50 feet from the trail, and I was completely lost. It was crazy. And you know me, Arlene, I have a really good sense of direction, so if I say I'm turned around, it's for real. We had one of our dogs with us, so I called him and he led me back to the trail, but man, it freaked me out. So imagine volunteers searching these woods they've never been in before. Stones are going to get left unturned, and it's really difficult to search everywhere.
Well, we know some of the people who searched for Brandon Lawson here in West Texas. They told us how difficult it is to do that kind of a search. And that wasn't even in a heavily wooded area. I know you like this theory the best, but I'd say this is a second behind someone in her inner circle killing her. I would think the older sister would have alerted David Morris that Desiree had wandered off.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Desiree Carroll was 2.5 years old at the time of her disappearance. She is white with brown hair and brown eyes and was 2'6", 40 pounds, and was wearing a blue turtleneck, brown coveralls, and red sneakers. She has a dog bite scar under her left eye. She would be nearly 44 years old today. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Desiree Carroll on March 25, 1983, please contact the Limestone County Sheriff's Office at 817-729-3278. Last and most likely, in my opinion, is that Desiree simply wandered off into the woods. This region where the family lived is referred to as the Big Woods, and based off pictures I've seen in the area, it would not be difficult for a 2-year-old child to just disappear. Saturday, November 10th, 1984. 6-year-old Bradley Gilbert and his 3-year-old brother Jason sprinted across the yard at their aunt's house in Chillicothe, Texas, chased by a man and his female companion, who pulled up alongside the property in a small, dirty car. Bradley shouted to his brother to get inside, and then the man grabbed Bradley and took him to his car. The boy's remains were found almost 6 months later, 16 miles away from the site of his abduction. As we approach the 40th anniversary of this case, investigators have very few answers as to who killed Bradley Gilbert.
1984 kicked off with Apple's iconic 1984-themed Macintosh Super Bowl ad, which almost single-handedly created the Super Bowl commercial industry as we know it today. The UK and China agreed that Hong Kong would return to Chinese control in 1997. UK miners started a strike that lasted nearly a year. American astronaut Bruce McCandless conducted the first untethered spacewalk. HIV was identified as the cause of AIDS. Crack, a smokable and cheaper form of cocaine, made its way to city streets, and Ronald Reagan was reelected as U.S. president. The L.A. Raiders beat the Washington Redskins in the Super Bowl. The Boston Celtics beat the L.A. Lakers for the NBA championship. The Edmonton Oilers defeated the New York Islanders for the Stanley Cup. And the Detroit Tigers beat the San Diego Padres in the World Series. The week of November 10th, Billy Ocean's Caribbean Queen was number one on the Billboard Hot 100, followed by Stevie Wonder and Prince and the Revolution. John Schneider topped the Billboard Hot Country charts with I've Been Around Enough to Know. The Terminator was number one at the box office that week, though Ghostbusters, the original Ghostbusters, would be the top-grossing film of the year. Lots of great movies in 1984, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Gremlins, The Karate Kid, Footloose. The Talisman by Stephen King and Peter Straub was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Dynasty, Dallas, and The Cosby Show were the most popular TV shows of the year. Chillicothe, Texas, is in the northern part of the state, just a few miles south of the Red River and the Oklahoma state border. It's a tiny town, recording a population of just 546 people in 2022. The railroads responsible for the settlement and growth of Chillicothe were the Fort Worth and Denver and the Santa Fe Railroads. The population of the town peaked in 1930 at just over 1,600 people, and it has been steadily declining ever since. In 1984, when Bradley Gilbert was abducted and murdered, just over 1,000 people called the town home. The hospital that served Chillicothe for over 70 years closed its doors permanently in 2019.
Bradley Gilbert was born on July 24, 1978, in Vernon, Texas, which is about a 15-minute drive southeast of Chillicothe, to Rita and Mitchell Gilbert. Bradley and his 3-year-old brother, Jason, were living with their mother in Chillicothe at the time of this incident. As their parents were separated at the time, the boy's father lived out of state. Bradley was in first grade in Chillicothe Elementary School. Bradley and his brother, Jason, were at their aunt's house just off of U.S. 287 in Chillicothe, Texas, on Saturday, November 10th, 1984. Playing in the space between the house and a nearby car wash at around 3:30 p.m. Several witnesses to this crime reported seeing a man drive up to the aunt's property in a small, dirty car. Jason Gilbert later told police that a man and a woman jumped out of the car and ran into the yard where the boys were playing. They chased the boys and eventually caught up to Bradley, taking him to the car and leaving. Jason continued playing in the yard afterward. Local law enforcement organized searches in the area, but turned up nothing. The Chillicothe police chief at the time, King Gilbreth, told a local paper, quote, "We looked again yesterday afternoon and this morning. We ran all the roads and checked all the culverts, bridges, and depressions in the area, but we didn't find anything," end quote. Investigators contacted Bradley's father, who was living out of state, and quickly determined that he did not have the boy in his custody and knew nothing about the disappearance. Bradley's family was convinced early on that he would be returned unharmed, and even put up flyers advertising a $1,000 reward for his safe return. The FBI and the Texas Rangers got involved with the search, which included aircraft and people searching on foot and on horseback. Days turned into weeks, which turned into months, and family and investigators alike began to lose hope that Bradley would be recovered alive. Everyone's greatest fears were confirmed on Sunday, March 31st, 1985, when two teenagers caught their fishing line on a badly decomposed human remains in a slough along the PC River, north of Vernon, Texas, approximately 16 miles from where Bradley was last seen. A slough is like a swampy, marshy area. The remains were later confirmed to be those of 6-year-old Bradley Gilbert. His throat had been cut, his shirt and shoes were missing, and his pants were pulled down around his ankles. The medical examiner's office couldn't determine exactly how long Bradley's remains had been in the river, but given the extent of decomposition, it was assumed they'd been in the water for some time. Investigators drained the slough to look for more evidence after the body was found, but I was unable to determine from the information I have if anything else was recovered. Obviously, nothing too significant, since the case is still unsolved and no arrests have been made.
So I actually did find something on that. The area where Bradley's remains were found is a pretty popular fishing spot, and divers were brought in to search it before it was partially drained. They found a whole bunch of things you'd expect to find at the community fishing hole: tennis balls, a football, some flip-flops, but nothing else belonging to Bradley, like his missing clothes or shoes. Searchers that were interviewed at the time were frustrated because that particular fishing hole is full of underwater plants and submerged tree limbs and other debris. It was slow going and very difficult to search.
We have witnesses that put a man stopping his car on a bridge over the river on US 283 on or about November 12, 1984, and throwing what appeared to be a garbage bag over the side. One of the investigators on the case believed that Bradley was killed and disposed of the same day, or very near to the time he was abducted, so this would track according to that potential timeline. This case went cold pretty quickly, and when the Hardin County Sheriff, at the time, Chester Ingram, stating just weeks after Bradley's body was found that he had some new leads, but that he wasn't close to identifying the killer.
That being said, investigators did get what appears from available information to be one pretty solid lead from these eyewitness statements, and that targeted a man from Oklahoma. The case actually heated up in the years following Bradley's discovery, and in 1987, Sheriff Ingram said of this person of interest, quote, "I think we've tapped on the man's shoulders. The thing we've got to do now is put everything together," end quote. Unfortunately, investigators were never able to put everything together, and this man from Oklahoma was never arrested or charged. He's also never been ruled out as a suspect.
So what do we think happened here?
They're rare, but this does sound to me like a stranger abduction. In 1984, the FBI reported 67 children abducted by strangers, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children recorded 142 cases. Most children who are actually kidnapped or abducted are taken by someone they know. In a lot of cases, it's a parent embroiled in a custody dispute. A lot of the quote-unquote stranger danger statistics, especially from the 1980s, were hyperinflated due to media coverage and mass hysteria. It's human nature.
I tend to agree with you here. This was a small town near the state border, and nobody recognized the car that pulls up to the house. Several witnesses reported seeing it, but they didn't know who it belonged to. at least not that they were aware of.
Did the police ever talk to the younger brother, Jason? I know he was only 3 at the time, but still.
Yes. Investigators spoke to him and even had him hypnotized to see if he remembered anything more. He reported seeing a man and a woman get out of the car and told police they chased him and Bradley, and that the man grabbed Bradley and took off with him. We mentioned that there were other witnesses who saw the man and possibly the woman pull up to Bradley's aunt's house in a dirty car. But like we said, there still hasn't been an arrest in this case.
And the reports we do have access to say that Bradley was missing his shirt and his shoes when he was found, and that his pants had been pulled down around his ankles. Was there any mention of sexual assault?
I remember reading a couple of articles that the Justice of the Peace and investigators suspected sexual assault may have been the motive for his kidnapping, but there was no way to tell for sure. His body had been in the water too long.
So again, there's not a whole lot of information out there on this case or on the suspect that was looked at early on, but we still need to get these stories out there. If you have any information regarding the kidnapping and murder of 6-year-old Bradley Eugene Gilbert in Chillicothe, Texas on November 10, 1984, please contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-252-TIPS. That's 1-800-252-8487. Or the Texas Rangers Cold Case Unit at 1-800-346-3243.
This podcast has a bigger purpose than just providing information and entertainment. The Homicide Victims Families' Rights Act is a bipartisan bill that was signed into law by Congress in 2021, and we want to see it put into action. This law establishes a systematic process for reviewing case files related to cold case murders. The focus is on providing a mechanism for the families and friends of murder victims to request a formal review of such cases. We need an attorney or teams of attorneys and legal professionals to take on the bold and brave fight against the system around the country. In our case, we need someone to fight for Leon to help not only put fresh eyes on the case, but to get his body exhumed to search for evidence that was not collected the first time around. We and other families and friends need assistance with getting FOIA requests. It blows our minds that so many murders occurred from 1976 to 1997 in Brownwood, Texas, under the watch of the same investigators responsible for handling Leon's case. We're going to look at all the unsolved murders in Brownwood, and maybe even a few solved ones if it helps uncover what was happening in that era that left so many families devastated and a community living in fear. If you want to hear more about victim-focused, unsolved cases and get updates about what we know, please subscribe, like, and share our podcast. Also, visit our website, justiceforleon.com, to donate to our cause to hire an attorney. You can also join our email list to stay current on developments on Leon's case and other cases we cover as they happen. Please follow and like our Facebook pages for Box in the Basement and Justice for Leon Laurelis, and follow our Instagram pages. I'd also like to ask that you sign my petition for my Uncle Leon Laurelis' case to be reopened and reviewed with fresh eyes. And you can find our petition on change.org. I also have a GoFundMe page to hire an attorney to help me get a copy of his autopsy that I have been denied for 27 years. You can find the GoFundMe by searching for Leon Laurelis. That's L-A-U-R-E-L-E-S. Thank you for joining us. Be kind. Later, Gators.